upholding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. Were included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And greetings to you, Patrick Wood. Here for Technocracy News and Trends. I'll ask you if this first story passes the smell test to you. In a recent broadcast, I talked about San Francisco closing off Market Street to pedestrian traffic only. Well, actually, that's not quite true. Pedestrian plus scooters plus bicycles plus city transit like buses, but basically there's no cars. And so people have to figure out an alternative means of transportation. And what they're hoping for is that you just simply start walking. And we saw then that the same thing showed up in Los Angeles, where somebody there now is suggesting that several streets in downtown Los Angeles should be shut off to automobiles and people should just start walking. And of course, you have the scooters, you have the electric bicycles that you can rent, and you also have city transit like trolleys or buses. And then, interestingly enough, my wife and I recently attended a transportation meeting in Mesa, Arizona, and lo and behold, one of the people in the audience piped up and suggested that one of the main arterial streets in downtown Mesa should be closed off to automobile traffic. This idea is spreading not just because it's a good idea. Somebody is seeding talking points around the country that downtown streets should be shut off to automobiles and everybody should just start walking and biking, etc. We know from Agenda 21 that cars have been demonized from day one. Well, day one was in 1992, but the push has been on to get people out of the automobiles and onto their feet and onto their bicycles and onto their scooters and whatever. I wrote at the top of this article, to justify smart cities where walking is the primary mode of transportation, researchers now claim that earnings and upward mobility increase in walkable cities where cars are diminished or eliminated. I'll read a few paragraphs of the article, and you decide whether or not this is the case or not. It starts out, the benefits of walkable neighborhoods are many and varied. Here we go. People who live in walkable neighborhoods are more active, healthier, and have more time to spend with family and friends and report higher levels of happiness and subjective well-being. This first paragraph, by the way, is just full of major assumptions that have not been proven. You know, smart cities haven't been around that long to where there's any time to do studies like this to figure out truly if people are healthier or if they're more active or if they have more time to spend with family and friends. It seems to me if you're walking everywhere instead of getting there quickly with an automobile or some other form of transportation, that you'd actually have less time to spend with family and friends. But anyway, this is a claim. This sets the tone for the article. Then it continues. Now, add another big benefit to the list. Children who live in walkable neighborhoods have higher levels of upward economic mobility. That's the key finding from a new study published in the American Psychologist. The study, The Socio-Ecological Psychology of Upward Social Mobility, by psychologists at Columbia University, the University of Virginia, and the University of Illinois at Urbana, looks at the effect of growing up in a walkable community on the economic mobility of children. The walkability measure comes from Walk Score. That's a website, by the way, where you can calculate your walk score. The economic mobility measured is based on the detailed data developed by economist Raj Chetty and his research team. Their data cover more than 9 million Americans born between 1980 and 1982 and gauges the probability that children from households in the bottom fifth of the income distribution will reach the top fifth by age 30. The new study looks at walkability across more than 380 commuting zones, the basic unit used by Chetty's team, which are similar to metro areas. It examines the effect of walkability in light of five key factors: school quality, income inequality, race, social capital, measured through community and civic participation, and the share of families with single parents that Chetty and others have found to be associated with economic mobility. Walkability has a sizable effect on upward economic mobility, according to the study. Indeed, walkability accounted for 11% of the additional variance in economic mobility above and beyond these five key factors. Statistically speaking, the size of the R2 for the model increased from 0.41 without walkability to 0.52 with walkability added to the five factors. The study considers the possibility that the result may reflect the effects not of walkability per se, but of other features of walkability like density or urbanity. Research by Chetty's team and others using their data has found economic mobility to be higher in communities that are denser or less sprawling and less segregated. To control for this, the study ran a series of additional models with variables for density, historic buildings, and other factors associated with urban neighborhoods. In all of these models, walkability remained closely associated with upward mobility. Stop and time out. You will notice that their study is based on models, that is, statistical models, computer models. And basically, they can make those models say anything they want. The point of this article and the point of all the propaganda around smart cities today and the removal of automobiles from the same depends on propaganda like this to convince people this is a wonderful thing. You'll love walking to work or walking to see your family members or maybe just sitting on a park bench and watching the people go by. You'll have a great time, no matter that you'll be wasting inordinate amounts of time on foot rather than actually being at the place you want to go. Well, this propaganda apparently is receiving us talking points from someone because articles like this just keep popping up and up and up. And more cities are talking about shutting off the downtown streets to automobiles. If you don't want this to happen in your city, I suggest you get close to your city council right now and make sure that they do not entertain changing your downtown streets to be carless. The next story is titled Digital Slavery: When China Gets Inside Your Head. This article is written for The American Conservative. I wrote to introduce it. Some call it surveillance capitalism, others green economy or sustainable development. Until technocracy is recognized for what it is, no one will fully understand what we are facing or what to do about it. This article is an otherwise good analysis of the state of China and the state of digital slavery in China, but it does not bring up the fact that China has morphed into a full-blown technocracy. It starts out, after reading the John Lanchester review of two new books on China's surveillance totalitarianism, I wrote about the Lanchester book here in connection with the NBA scandal, I bought one of the titles. That title is We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State by Kai Strittmatter. As regular readers know, I am forced by my new book project to limit my readings to subjects related to totalitarianism. From Lanchester's review, I sussed that what's going on in China today is exactly what I fear is coming here. Regarding soft totalitarianism, I stayed up to midnight last night reading Strittmatter's book, It's Stunning Stuff. The future I had been imagining all year as I've worked on this project already exists in China. Excerpts from the book by Strittmatter, a German journalist who lived and worked in China, quote, "The China we once knew no longer exists. The China that was with us for 40 years, the China of reform and opening up, is making way for something new. It's time for us to start paying attention. Something is happening in China that the world has never seen before. A new country and a new regime are being born. And it's also time for us to take a look at ourselves. Are we ready? Because one thing is becoming increasingly clear. Over the coming decades, the greatest challenge for our democracies and for Europe, won't be Russia. It will be China. Within its borders, China is working to create the perfect surveillance state, and its engineers of the soul are again trying to craft the, quote, new man of whom Lenin, Stalin, and Mao once dreamed. And this China wants to shape the rest of the world in its own image. Now, this quotation from Strip Matter's book is astute. China indeed is changing. The China we once knew indeed no longer exists. But what it is not an extension of Mao's communism or Lenin's communism or Stalin's communism. It's altogether different. That party has right, but he does not recognize it as being technocracy. The article continues, emphasis mine, more from Strip Matter's book. Quote, the party believes it can use big data and artificial intelligence to create steering mechanisms that will catapult its economy into the future and make its apparatus crisis-proof. By the way, this is the exact definition of technocracy. This was their original intent. At the same time, it intends to use this technology to create the most perfect surveillance state the world has ever seen. Ideally, one where you can't even see the surveillance, because the state has planted it inside the heads of its subjects. This new China won't be a giant parade ground characterized by asceticism and discipline, as it was under Mao, but an outwardly colorful mix of George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where people devote themselves to commerce and pleasure, and in doing so, submit to surveillance of their own accord. Still, for the vast majority of subjects, the potential threat of state terror will remain ever-present, the background radiation in this party universe. The article continues, this state of living is hard to imagine in the U.S., but not as hard as it ought to be. Almost every day I hear from readers, some in corporate America, some in academia, who tell me stories about how they walk on eggshells in their workplace out of fear of saying something that offends against political correctness. This almost always has to do with homosexuality or transgenderism. One lawyer told me recently that in his white shoe law firm, everyone during the Pride Month was expected to take one of the firm-provided rainbow flags and display it at their desk as a sign of solidarity. He declined to do it. He said not one word about LGBT, but his Bartleby the Scrivener-like withholding of assent was the only one like it in the entire firm. He is sure that it was noticed and that this is going to have consequences at some point. What is so interesting to me about this is that people are not simply afraid of saying the wrong thing. They are afraid of failing to say the right thing. Political correctness lives in their heads because it has, or can have, real-world consequences for them. Nobody is going to a gulag because they refuse to use the politically correct pronoun. But doing that sets one apart as politically unreliable, a bigot who contributes to a, quote, hostile work environment that makes LGBT people feel unsafe and paves the way for a future dismissal. Now, an employee may know that when he refers to a man in the dress in the workplace as she, that he is following a professional convention and that the language does not reflect biological reality. Perhaps he feels safe in recognizing that he only has to lie in that way at the office. But consider that more and more of us will be going into private spaces, our homes, the homes of our friends, that are monitored by smart speakers. We know that those things monitor and even record our conversations, and that in some cases, these conversations are stored. People love smart speakers. Alexa, play some John Coltrane. They are becoming accustomed to living with that technology because it makes life more convenient and pleasant. In this way, they are becoming accustomed to being monitored. If the government installed a smart speaker in your house, you would scream bloody murder. But if you order one from Amazon and use it to fulfill your consumer needs, you welcome surveillance technology into your living room. This is how it's going to happen in America. This is how it is happening in America. We're going to swallow the bitter pill of technocratic tyranny because it is covered with the honeyed narcotic of consumer convenience. I recommend that you read this article in total. Even though he does not mention technocracy by name, he understands the concept of technocratic. And indeed, as Aldous Huxley wrote in his later book in 1958, It was called Brave New World Revisited. He said exactly this, that in a perfect scientific dictatorship, people would come to love their slavery. The last story has been kicking around for a while. The title of it is Omniviolence is Coming and the World Isn't Ready. I wrote in this article raises interesting concerns about the ability of violence to be projected from anywhere in the world toward any target. Psychopaths of the future will use technology to disrupt the functioning of the nation state. Technocrats build because they can, not because there's a need to do so. Ethics and morality are seldom a consideration. This article states, in The Future of Violence, Benjamin Wittes and Gabriella Blum discuss a disturbing hypothetical scenario. A lone actor in Nigeria, home to a great deal of spamming and online fraud activity, tricks women and teenage girls into downloading malware that enables them to monitor and record their activity for the purposes of blackmail. The real story involved a California man who the FBI eventually caught and sent to prison for 6 years. But if he had been elsewhere in the world, he might have gotten away with it. Many countries, as Wittes and Blum note, have neither the will nor the means to monitor cybercrime, prosecute offenders, or extradite suspects to the United States. Technology is, in other words, enabling criminals to target anyone anywhere, and due to democratization, increasingly at scale. Emerging bio, nano, and cyber technologies are becoming more and more accessible. The political scientist Daniel Dewdney has a word for what can result: omni-violence. The ratio of killers to killed, or KK ratio, is falling. For example, computer scientist Stuart Russell has vividly described how a small group of malicious agents might engage in omniviolence. A very, very small quadcopter, 1 inch in diameter, can carry a 1 or 2 gram shaped charge, he says. You can order them from a drone manufacturer in China. You can program the code to say, here are thousands of photographs of the kinds of things I want to target. A 1 gram shaped charge can punch a hole in 9 millimeters of steel. So presumably, you can punch a hole in someone's head. You can fit about 3 million of those in a semi-tractor trailer. You can drive up I-95 with 3 trucks and have 10 million weapons attacking New York City. They don't have to be very effective. Only 5 or 10% of them would have to find the target. Manufacturers will be producing millions of these drones, available for purchase, just as guns now, Russell points out, except millions of guns don't matter unless you have a million soldiers. You need only 3 guys to write the program and launch. In this scenario, the KK ratio could be perhaps 3 to 1 million, assuming 10% accuracy and only a single 1 gram shaped charge per drone. That's completely and horrifyingly unprecedented. The terrorist or psychopath of the future, however, will not have just the internet or drones, called slaughterbots in this video, from the Future Life Institute, but also synthetic biology, nanotechnology, and advanced AI systems at their disposal. These tools make wreaking havoc across the international borders trivial, which raises the question, will emerging technologies make the state system obsolete? It's hard to see why not. What justifies the existence of the state, English philosopher Thomas Hobbes argued, is a social contract. People give up certain freedoms in exchange for state-provided security, whereby the state acts as a neutral referee that can intervene when people get into disputes, punish people who steal and murder, and enforce contracts signed by parties with competing interests. The trouble is that if anyone anywhere can attack anyone anywhere else, then states will become and are becoming unable to justify their primary duty as referee. It's a trend towards anarchy, the war of all against all, as Hobbes put it. In other words, a condition of everyone living in constant fear of being harmed by their neighbors. Indeed, in a recent paper, The Vulnerable World Hypothesis, published in Global Policy, the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom argues that the only way to defend against a global catastrophe is to employ a universal and invasive surveillance system, what he calls a high-tech panopticon. Sound dystopian? Sure does to me. Bostrom writes, creating and operating the high-tech panopticon would require substantial investment, but thanks to the falling prices of cameras, data transmission, storage, and computing, and the rapid advances in AI-enabled content analysis, it may soon become both technologically feasible and affordable. Bostrom is well aware of the downsides. Corrupt actors in the state could exploit this surveillance for totalitarian ends, or hackers could blackmail unsuspecting victims. Yet the fact is that it may still be a better option than suffering one global catastrophe after another. I'll have to say that if you're easily creeped out, don't listen to the video in this article. On the other hand, if you remember that it's just a dramatization, it might be in your best interest to listen to it so you can see where the technology to destroy people is going. It's not pretty. But there's still time to do something about it. Killer robots, for sure, need to be completely outlawed throughout the world. Will this ever happen? It's too early to know. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. We'll see you next time. We'll be right back.